In this hour, we'll take your calls with Peter Cochran, author of AI and Policing. So get ready to make the call when we come right back. And welcome back with Peter Cochran and your phone calls as well. Peter, with artificial intelligence, what would have Albert Einstein have done if he had the firepower with computers today? Would he have gotten E equals MC squared like that?
I think he would have got a lot further than he did, shall we say, because Albert was a great theoretical thinker. He didn't do experiments, he did mind experiments. But the power of computer modeling, I think, would have enticed him. I do know, if I take a good example, Crick and Watson, took them about 3 years to come to the conclusion that the genome was a double helix, and
the AI
system gets there in a matter of minutes. So I think there's no doubt about it. One of the underlying mechanisms of human progress has been that every phase of technology that we've created has allowed us to do things faster. We invented a hammer, we could build faster. We invented a bow and arrow, allowed us to make a lathe. We could start turning wood, then we could turn metal, and then we could make machines, and so on. And so each technology accelerates our progress because it gives us greater capability, and that's certainly true of AI. AI is now discovering new drugs instead of lots and lots of people in white coats in laboratories doing trial and error. So, yes, the technology makes a difference.
Let's go to our first-time caller, Ed, in Sierra Madre, California. Edward, go ahead, sir.
Thanks, George.
Thank you.
Yeah, I wondered whether Peter would have something to say about the Turing test and whether AI, artificial intelligence in its current state, maybe including quantum computing, would be considered to having passed the Turing test and all its extensive requirements. I would have thought that, for instance, it could fool me into thinking I was talking to, let's say, Woody Allen or something.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm not sure that's in the cards. So do you have anything in that line?
Sure. I think there are several demonstrations, some of which are on YouTube, of receptionists replaced by AI. And I have to say, a lot of the time, the AI sounds smarter than a human being. So in limited veins, I think, yes, it has. What you can't say is that AI, in the general sense, has exceeded human capability. Of course not. So let me just give you a historical perspective. When the first computers were made, they were things like controlling gunnery systems on ships or creating the payroll for a company, or analyzing specific groups of data. You made a computer for a particular purpose. Now, gradually, we got programmable computers, and we got general purpose computing, and that is what you've got on your desk right now. So, and the cracking of the Enigma code is a good example. That machine was incredibly good at cracking the code and doing nothing else. We're following the same track with AI. We're building task-specific AIs, and we're also doing the same thing with quantum computing. Right now, we're building task-specific quantum computers. The transition will come further up the rung of progress, where we get general-purpose AI that then will definitely pass the Turing test under all conditions. Right now, the Turing test has been exceeded or pushed to one side in very specific and limited areas.
And Peter, you do know right now you're being interviewed by a computer-generated voice, but it's computer-generated. How would you know? Is that conceivable?
No. It is... It is actually sometimes difficult to decide that somebody on the end of the line is actually human when they are. You can have conversations that are unbelievable, and you think, well, is this a spoof? In fact, we've got a couple of TV programs in the UK which is to do with people telling very convincing lies, and to see how you might detect whether it's a lie or not. And it's actually very difficult. So one of the things I got engaged in a couple of years ago was building a truth engine for that very purpose, to take a look at a statement and then make a calculated judgment, was it correct or not. And so that involved AI, looking at people and AI, because a lot of the spoof stuff now that is on the internet is generated by machines. So you may or may not be aware, but the majority of the financial reports that are now coming out of the markets are generated by AI. They're not written by people. There's a deal of journalism that is now written by AI as well. So this stuff is getting pretty smart.
Next up, Cornelius is with us in Alexandria, Louisiana. Hello there, Cornelius. Mr. White, how are you?
Hey, George. And I want to salute all the veterans. Me and you are veterans and stuff like that. And I've got a question for both of y'all. Me and Tommy were talking. George, I don't know how you pick your music, but that's the best bumper music I've ever heard. So you and Tommy must know something about
it. We all contribute to it. Dan does, I do, and Tom has picked a few once in a while.
I was wondering how y'all did all that. Peter, my question for you, I don't know if you've ever seen these shows. There's a show called Person of Interest. It was on CBS. It's on WGN now, Chicago Superstation. And there's a new show on Fox called Next. The one on Fox called Next is an AI that's evil, that's determined to destroy the world. On Person of Interest, it was two AIs. One was a good AI that loved humans and stuff like that, and another one was a bad AI that essentially hated humans and wanted to destroy mankind. And I just worry, because AIs are programmed by humans, humans have a tendency to destroy each other. So I don't think AIs would be good from my perspective. So I just want to hear yours, and thank you so much, George and Tommy.
Sure thing, Cornelius. Go ahead, Peter.
Well, one of the biggest engineering problems we face with AI is the building in of human bias. So if you look at the American judiciary and the use of AI, the AI has been built by human beings, and a lot of the decisions that are made by the AI are inherently human-driven. And so you find inside the American system the emergence of racial bias, for example, within the decision-making. Now, the engineering effort to take that out is to get several AIs made by several different teams in several different countries, give them the same case, let them analyze it, and then start to weed out the human bias. Again, it's not the AI that's the problem. It's the human beings that have influenced you, quite right. But America has a very interesting quality. Cornelius, you have just illustrated it quite nicely. Without a shadow of a doubt, the population of the U.S. are the most paranoid on the planet. And this is, I think, to some extent, is fueled by the U.S. media and, of course, Hollywood in particular, because the downside, the evil, coming to get you, and it's going to hurt and you can't do anything about it kind of approach, is the most appealing for entertainment. It's the most thrilling. The good side is a little bit flatter. You know, it just solves the problem and it keeps you healthy and it provides you food and clothing and your transport and everything else. But that's not an exciting story. And so it's really... doesn't surprise me that people get worried about it when they see this stuff, but I think they have to get a grip on reality. Engineers and scientists do not get up in the morning and think, I had a bad day yesterday, I think I'll have an even worse one today, I didn't kill enough people yesterday, I'll kill some more today. We have families, we are married. I'll give you an example. I'm married. I have six children. I have 10 grandchildren. I have lots of friends.
Well, good for
I wouldn't
you.
Do anything to help them. To hurt them.
Hurt them. You would do everything to help them.
I'd do everything to help them. And so there is an army, an absolute army of engineers and scientists who are dedicated to preventing those kinds of scenarios happening. The stuff that goes out that you see is tested inside out to the best of our ability to make sure that it doesn't hurt people. And I have worried, and I know all my professional friends have, I have worried every day of my life when I've been working on people critical systems that if I make a mistake, I could hurt someone. So we put an awful lot of effort in. We have ethical committees that we have to get through with our proposals. We are tested all the time. We test each other. We take the greatest care. Now, that's not to say that something might slip through. That has been the history of human beings. We have made mistakes. You may or may not be aware, but your planning laws for the design of buildings with fire escapes and things like that have come about by killing people. We put up buildings, there's been a disaster, people have died, there's been a post-mortem, we've looked at the building design, the building codes have been changed so that that doesn't happen again. That has been a progression of refinement of the building codes. Now we have AI simulations where we can program a population of people in a building, have a disaster, a fire or whatever, and we can emulate very, very accurately what is going to happen. We can have the guy or gal sat at the desk who hears a fire alarm and say, well, it was just a test, I won't move. We have the person who runs and panics. We have the person who grabs the fire extinguisher and runs to the fire to try and put it out. We have every scenario, and that has enhanced our ability to design buildings, aircraft, transport systems, vehicles, a huge amount without hurting people. So that's the upside. It's quite boring when you compare it for entertainment to two AI systems competing, one to save us and one to kill us.
You ever see the day where AI will be emotional?
That is something that is being worked on quite avidly, both on AI and robotics. I think you have the same problem in the US, certainly Japan, China, Europe, UK have this problem of not enough caring people. And what I mean is, as populations get older, we find we don't have enough humans to look after the older population. Japan has invested very heavily in robots in that direction, but they are a little bit like blocks of concrete moving around. They're not empathic. They don't relate to humans. And there's quite a bit of effort to going into that. When you have a conversation with an AI, it can be really flat. So, 35 years ago, I assigned a team they were working on speech technology, and I gave them a mission to get the computer to say to me, I love you, with sarcasm, with irony, with anger.
Without passion, huh?
Without passion, with passion. So, and they failed. And the reason they failed was we didn't have the technology 35 years ago. Now it's getting pretty damn good. And so empathic technology is something that is on the wish list of what we should be able to achieve with AI.
Next up, let's go to Rob in Boston, Mass. Hey, Robbie, go ahead.
Hey, good morning, gentlemen.
Morning, Rob.
Good morning, Robbie.
Peter, thank you. So, Peter, I hear you saying on one hand that AI is not set to hurt people. However, things always slip through. And I can't help but think of self-driving cars, for instance, as well as coronavirus. And I would like to present to you, how did a virus like COVID make it out of the lab? And how come it's not told to the public?
Well, first of all, I can categorically say that all the genetic evidence is that that coronavirus did not occur in the lab. It occurred in nature. It came about through, if you like, the crowding of animals closely together. It's just another one of the many conspiracy theories that...
I'm a lab believer, by the way, Peter, just so you know.
No, that's okay. I don't mind what people believe. I'm a scientist. I go with facts, and I go with evidence. So looking at the evidence provided by several bodies looking at the genetics of the virus, it didn't come out of the lab. It's not being manufactured. There are many other things in laboratories around the world that could come out of the lab that's actually much, much worse than COVID-19. If you were destined to try and do a lot of damage, you wouldn't use COVID-19. It's not all that effective. It kills so few people. There are things that are far more dangerous that you could let loose.
I bet.
So the problem here is we have people, once people are locked into a belief system, exactly like religion, once people get into a belief system, they stop thinking. They know. Well, science isn't like that. Science does not provide you with certainty. It provides you with possibilities, and you have to make rational decisions, and it's hard work. So, you know, where did this lab theory came from? It came from a political bias. And so it was propagated for various reasons. Now people believe it. You can't shake people in their belief systems. It's impossible.
Well, the ironic part about that, too, is they have a viral lab in Wuhan where this all started. And it just is weird. We apparently, as a country, gave them $3.7 million through Anthony Fauci, the infectious disease guy in this country. And so when you add all that up, Peter, it does add to the conspiracy.
That's like saying you found a special code in the Bible that proves the existence of God. If you go looking for evidence or patterns, you will find it. So the biggest mistake people make when they're not scientists, they go looking for evidence that will prove their theory. That's not the right way around. You should not confuse cause, effect, or causality and outcome. You have to be very, very careful and go through it. So you can put all kinds of spurious things together. And, I mean, to denigrate Fauci is quite something. That is just outrageous. There is a respected scientist who's done a great job of work for the American people.
Hold on, Peter. We're at the half here, but we'll come back and wrap things up with final calls. And welcome back to our final segment. George Norrie with you. Peter Cochran with us. His book, AI and Policing. Peter, where do people get that book if they want to pick it up?
It's available on the web. It's you can access it via my homepage. And in fact, let me just quickly look up the reference for you. Just one second.
Okay. And we've got your website as petercochran.com and also cochran.org.uk if people want to use that.
Yeah, the org has been closed down. It's just petercochran.com.
Okay.
Is now it. So, if you go into publications, it's right down at the bottom under 2020. And.
And while you're looking for that, what other new projects are you working on?
My number one thread is I'm looking at sentience. I completed a project on a truth engine last year. We couldn't get sufficient funding, but we got a working prototype, and that was very edifying. Everybody's looking for a sort of silver bullet, one solution to a problem, but looking at something that somebody says or writes and deciding if it's true or not requires a multiplicity of techniques. But on the first shot, we got accuracies of over 84%, and we got an awful lot.
Oh, that's huge.
One of the outcomes was really interesting is that when you examine the truth of organizations, actually the Wall Street Wall Street Journal came out number one in the world with BT very, the BBC very close, and you know, right down at the bottom of the list with people like Breitbart and those kinds of people.
Super. While you're looking for that reference, let's go take some calls. You got it? Okay.
It's a Springer publication, and it's I've got the ISBN number if anybody wants that, but it's a bit long. But if you go onto the Springer catalog and look for policing in the era of AI and smart societies, that's where it is. It was published in April of this year.
All right, let's go to Joe in Monterey, California. Hey, Joe, go ahead, sir.
Thank you for taking my call, George.
Sure, Joe. My pleasure.
And I'd like to start off by saying I am not a robot.
You are not. I might be.
Well, that's okay. At least one of us is sentient. And this is why I called. At one point, does AI become conscious? And we're talking about conscious, like a human consciousness. And I don't mean the brain, but the mind. And we know through scientific experimentation that the mind and the brain are two different entities, that the mind interfaces, and that's the key here, interfaces with the brain. AI, to do AI as a conscious thing, it has to interface with something that can transcend itself. And mankind has a history of transcendence, inspired writing, inventions that come out of the blue, dream interpretations, and they discover something. I mean, we have a history of this. And some of the great scientists have been, I don't want to say religious, but inspired by their higher self. And this is an area that AI has to face. Now, we also have a problem with this as well. As a human being, if we go through this transhumanism or interfacing with computer AI through chips, will we as a race stop evolving because we are dependent on a computer and not our inspired self?
Well, Joe, the answer to that one is nobody knows. What I can say is that AI, as of today, has reinvented lots of things that human beings have already invented in terms of technology. It can certainly compose music that's on a par with that of human beings, and there are many things that it can do. And the snag is with the area as a whole is we don't even have good definitions of what we're talking about. It's very, very hard to have a conversation in this area because there's no way of doing measurements or quantifying it without having it defined. So my efforts have been, first of all, to find a way of quantifying intelligence, start naked, disconnected intelligence. And so let me give you an example. People will say, well, we came from the apes. Actually, we came from the grass. We came from the same stardust. Everything on this planet came from the same stardust. We share the same genetic code as a blade of grass, as a worm, and everything else. So we're all made of the same fundamental material. And surprise, surprise, you find that plants actually do communicate. You find that insect species communicate. And they do it at various levels. Now, the big mistake, I think, that has been made and is made is always to take the human being as the benchmark and say AI is not intelligent till it's equal to us or surpasses us. It has to be aware. It has to be sentient. And we know what that is. Actually, we don't. That just confuses the whole issue. So the way science is going about this is a little bit at a time, very cautiously, and building up a picture. And where your end point is, we don't know. But this is what we do know. When people have been damaged or hurt or in some way disadvantaged, when we implant an electronic artificial eye or a cochlear implant and we can give them sight and sound, it improves their life. It's not as good as the biological equipment they originally were born with yet, but in some cases, the results have been astounding. Repairing the spinal column when it's been severed with silicon. So I look at this and I say, well, there's a race on here, and it's between carbon and silicon, if you will. In some case, we are combining carbon and silicon, by the way, by growing nerve cells on chips interfacing. And it's been done with prosthetics. So if you go back to the Civil War in the United States, if you got your leg shot off, you got a wooden stick. If you had your arm shot off, you got a crude wooden or mechanical arm. Now the arms are articulated, they're connected to our nervous system, and it brings back life to people now.
And they look almost real.
They're almost real, but of course one of the things that is a big problem is the amount of nerve endings on the end of the fingers, the palm of the hand, are difficult to replicate. And the best example I can think of is, you know, my mother-in-law, who died many years ago, as she got older, she became more childlike, and we took her out somewhere. Unfortunately, they had plastic cups, and she gripped it, and the fluid went everywhere, because she lost the ability to actually sense the strength of the material and didn't understand. Now, there's a lot of effort being put into creating robots that can pick up an egg, or as I would put it, you know, pick up a grain of rice and put it in your mouth without smashing your teeth. That's the sort of dexterity that we take for granted that's now being built into robotics to help human beings at disadvantage. So we learn in science a little bit at a time. Where you are, Joe, is a giant leap into the future. And the answer is no one knows. My own instinct on this is, if you were to plug in some phenomenal amount of computing math capability to my brain, it would immediately enhance my ability. It could be catastrophic, but we don't know that. So you can bet your bottom dollar we're going to go into that area just a little bit at a time. And most of what we know about the human brain and how we work has actually been gained until recently by looking at people who've had massive brain damage, and learning from what they've lost rather than how it works or what they gained. With the MRI scanners we've now got, we can actually see the brain functioning, and we're starting to try and unpick what it is that is actually happening. The level of complexity of this is beyond our ability as a species to understand without, at the very least, AI, and most probably we're going to need quantum computers to help us unravel that mystery.
Peter, are these Neuralinks that Elon Musk is working on to put in the brain, are they, would you call, revolutionary and a breakthrough?
It's been tried before. What is revolutionary is that the chippery, if you like, the actual technology is getting much more powerful than
sure is.
Earlier technology. You know, a good example would be, you probably remember Seymour Cray and his supercomputers. I knew Seymour real well, and I can once remember saying to him, I wonder if ever I'll get this computer of yours, this Cray 2, in my back pocket, and we both laughed. I have to tell you, I've got 20 times the computing power of the Cray 2 in my hand right now. It's called an iPhone. And it's stunning. I work in the industry. I'm absolutely stunned at how far we've managed to progress.
Oh, it's dramatic. Oh, my God. It's
very dramatic. People pick these blocks up and use them like they're nothing. They do not realize that they have got more computing power in their hand than was on the planet in 1970. I mean, that's the scale of the compression.
Well, we've got more computing power in our hand than they had when they went to the moon with Apollo 11.
Yeah, I've got more computing than that in my wristwatch.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, no, no. So these progressions are quite dramatic. So and by the way, I've met Elon Musk a couple of times. He's a really interesting guy. But he's pushing the boat out there, and I'm intrigued to see what he will do. But
yeah, he's a genius.
A colleague of mine in the UK, way back, nearly 30 years ago, had a chip inserted in his arm, and then he had a chip inserted in his wife's arm, and they were connected together. My view of that was I don't need that. My wife knows what I'm thinking all the time.
Anyway. Yeah, they do. They have that power. Let's go to some more calls for you, Peter. Annette's with us in Millville, Indiana. Hi, Annette. Go ahead.
Hi, good morning. I want to go back to where you were just before the break, and I don't want to talk about a potential hoax. What I want to talk about is differing opinions in the scientific community. Early on in the pandemic, back in, I'm going to say it was late January, maybe the early part of February, and I apologize for not remembering names, but there was a French scientist. He won the Nobel Prize for his work with HIV. His opinion was, based on science, that the coronavirus, it's not that it was man-made, but that it was man-altered. My concern is also that at the same time, a separate field of scientists in India, I believe there were 9 of them on the research project, also came to a very similar conclusion. And the French scientists said that because it was man-altered, and this was their opinion, this was their findings, so I think it's important that we do allow for differing opinions in the scientific community, but my question is, he stated that if we did nothing at all, there would be great loss of life here, which is partly what I think we're seeing in the United States. But he said eventually it would die off because it could not replicate. I won't even go there because I'm not the scientist, and I don't remember every word.
And we've only got about 40 seconds left in that, so let's get some quick reaction. His name was Montagnier, by the way, his last name. He was an epidemiologist and virologist. Peter, we've only got 30 seconds left, and you want to chime in on this?
Sure. The way science works is very straightforward. You form a hypothesis, you perform an experiment, you come up with some facts and figures, you publish them. Then the rest of the scientific community have a go, and they check it out, and they try and prove it or disprove it, and gradually a consensus emerges. A consensus has now emerged. On the way, there have been many opinions. Opinions, not a scientific proof. What is a scientific proof is a detailed examination of the genetic trail. That has now been completed, and that constitutes not an opinion, but a scientific track that gives a degree of proof, if you like. Let me say again, science never gives you certainty. It gives you the most likely solution, and the least likely solution appears to be it was made in lab.
Peter, let's not let 7 years go by again this time, okay?
That'll be great. Been a joy, and thanks for all the music.
Okay, my friend, you take care of yourself. For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Latasur, Stephanie Smith, Chris Boros, Tim Banal, Ian Punnett, and George Knapp. I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.